This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. There have been a lot of headlines recently as far as the legal landscape in Malaysia is concerned. I mean, you would have heard a lot about the Sedition Act, splashed all over our newspapers and online portals. You would have heard about custodial death, which, everyone's talking about. But what's really going on? Well, we have Edmund Bond, human rights lawyer, in the studio with us. Edmund's going to shed some light on some of the recent developments. Edmund's been in the centre of some of it, actually. Welcome to the show. Edmund, how
Good
are you
afternoon.
Today?
I'm okay.
How are you holding up? Lots going on.
Yeah, I think it's exciting times. I think it's a good way for people to talk about the Sedition Act, and there's a lot of opposition to it. It's how we progress in a democracy.
Right. You're being investigated under the Sedition Act over an article that was published on an online news portal. Now, you want to give us a lowdown as to how that developed and, where it's actually going at the moment?
The Kalima Allah decision by the Court of Appeal and Federal Court, of course, sparked a lot of controversy. And when the press asked me about the fatwa that says non-Muslims cannot use the word Allah, I said, well, the fatwa only applies to Muslims. Mm-hmm. And that's very clear from the article. So I cannot understand how people can misinterpret that kind of statement. And I had a pleasant interview with the investigating officer, and I asked him, what actually did the police report say? And the police report said that my statement was to incite hatred and to incite people to go against the ruler and the government, mm-hmm. Which was never my intention. And they misinterpreted the statement. So the police report actually said that I said fatwa should not apply to anyone, should not apply to all, including right. Muslims. But it's so clear from the statement that that's not what I said. Mm-hmm. And it is the law, it is correct to say, and we have cases to that effect, even by the federal court, to say that fatwas only apply to Muslims.
Right. We'll come to the Sedition Act and try and understand it a little bit more, Edmund. But was that a legal opinion, what you actually gave out to the press? Was that a legal opinion?
Yeah, of course. In fact, the case is even mentioned in the news article. Yep. At Sulaiman Takrib.
So is a legal opinion, does that violate the Sedition Act?
A legal opinion should not violate the Sedition Act. And I think you'll be asking about Kapal Singh's opinion and yes. Azmi Sharum's opinion. It's clearly absurd. You are giving an opinion as an academic, as a lawyer, speaking about the state of the law. You may not agree with some of the cases. You may not agree with some of the judgments of the court, but it by no means can be seditious. The problem is how the courts have interpreted the Sedition Act from Ui Kee Siak, Mark Koding, for the longest time. And the courts have said you do not need to show that there was actual threat of harm or violence. You do not need to show actual incitement. You do not need to show people rioting on the streets. All you need to show is that if that statement has seditious tendencies, which would include saying something against the ruler, saying something against the government. And that's really wide. If you want to apply that test, many people will be charged today.
Oh, yes. Half the population will be charged under the Sedition Act.
Yeah, it's just absurd because the Sedition Act is 1948. It's time we move on.
Correct. Let's just go back to that time. It came to be, there was a reason why the Sedition Act came to be in 1948. Why?
The simple argument really was the British wanted to silence the people who were opposed to their rule. And one of the laws they left behind, besides the ISA in the 60s, in 1960, was the Sedition Act. The ISA has now gone, the emergency ordinance has now gone. The police, the Attorney General has really nothing to go on except to use the Sedition Act. And it's disappointing that the government is using colonial law to go against its own citizens.
And is there any use for the Sedition Act? I mean, if there is a need, a genuine need to use the Sedition Act at some stage, and we're calling for us to repeal the Sedition Act. If it isn't in place, Edmund, then what causes government have to fall back on if we do in fact get rid of it?
We already have the Penal Code, and that Penal Code allows you to go after a person if there is really incitement and hatred. And the test is much higher. The prosecution has to show intention. The Sedition Act, you do not need to show intention. So your intention can be in good faith. You can be speaking the truth, but yet you can be found to have committed sedition. And now you have the National Harmony Bills that is being used now and in process of consultation. I think we have to look at all those. Human rights, in human rights, we talk about free speech, but we also say that you need to, you can only limit free speech if there is real incitement, if there is hatred, and you can actually see these threats available as evidence.
But who decides that, Edmund?
I think the AG and the police will have to decide that, but the law is you must show it. Here, under the Sedition Act, you do not need to show it. And you can see the investigations have gone back. What Kapal Singh said, what Azmi said, what I said, for example, mm-hmm. many people said, you do not see people taking to the streets because I think we are all rational and peace-loving people. Malaysians are generally, I think, very peaceful, very loving. And what this is doing is actually breaking apart the fabric of our society.
Mm-hmm. The late Kapal Singh, he was convicted of sedition for giving a legal opinion in 2009 during the para-constitutional crisis. Now, how was he found guilty?
Well, as I said just now, they just went on a seditious tendency that he has tried to point out that the ruler might have been wrong in.
So it's a legal opinion again?
Yes, of course, it's a legal opinion, and I think that's under appeal. So we will have to wait and see how the court decides.
Mm-hmm. And Azmi Sharam, of course, has made headlines. A lot of supporters, coming up to support Azmi, and to a very large extent. Academic freedom, of course, is what we're concerned about here. Is Azmi's case any different from Karpal's case?
No different. It's a legal opinion. What the case is doing is that it is actually radicalizing a lot of academics and a lot of the people in the universities. And even Azmi himself, I've had the pleasure of seeing him in some of the rallies at UM, and he's really taking it on. And I think that is what is required in our society now.
Yeah, Azmi's team of legal team told the session court just a couple of days ago that the Sedition Act is unconstitutional because it was not a law passed in Parliament. Is there much grounds for that?
Yes, there is grounds for that. That's one ground that they have taken to challenge the Sedition Act. There was another ground that we have taken before, which is that it's unconstitutional because it breaches Article 10, violates Article 10, freedom of expression. We lost that, but we have filed a new suit. And that is in respect of Mat Suhaimi Shafi, mm-hmm. the Sri Muda Adun, and Tian Chua's case as well. So we will have to wait to see. There are some constitutional arguments that can be made, and I hope Azmi's case will be the case that will strike down the Sedition Act on that score.
As a lawyer, I mean, how would you put up a defence for a client charged with sedition?
It's very difficult because the prosecution doesn't need to prove intention. And there's some sort of presumption that is seditious, so long as you attack the king or the ruler or the sultan or the government. There are limited defences to say that if your intention was to attack, but to point out an error and to correct that error, there's that limited defence. So a lot of lawyers would try to raise that defence in the case. And I'm sure there's so many cases now, we're going to see this defense being raised a bit more. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's just our hope that as the bar has passed the recent resolution to walk and march and hand a memorandum, that it will have some impact in Parliament quickly repealing the Sedition Act, calling for a moratorium, and the AG dropping all the charges.
Mm-hmm. And the Prime Minister did say that he had intentions to get rid of the Sedition Act and sort of come up with a Harmony Act instead. Nothing much has happened in that area?
Well, I think there's a lot of consultation on the bills. And I understand from the bar and many lawyers ourselves, we are in full support of what Prime Minister has said. It's quite rare that we support statements, but you know, we I think a lot of us are really appreciative that the PM has said this, and we want the Sedition Act to be repealed. The problem is we do not understand how the AG, albeit he must be independent, is taking up so many sedition cases when the Prime Minister has said, look, hold on, I'm reviewing it, I'm repealing it, I've set up these committees, there's these bills going around being consulted. So there's some sort of mismatch between the PMO's office, the PM's statements and the AG's chambers.
We'll come back and find out more about developments in the Malaysian legal scene. If you have a question for Edmund, he's in the studio, 0377 10 9000 or 0162 01 9000. Send us a text message. We'll be happy to answer some of those questions. Coming up, we'll find out whether anyone is immune from the Sedition Act on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasuthi. In the studio with me, Edmund Bon, human rights lawyer. We're discussing developments in the Malaysian legal scene. As I mentioned earlier, Edmund has pretty much been in the news recently, being investigated under the Sedition Act. Edmund, holding up pretty well, I have to say, Edmund.
Enjoying myself.
Thoroughly indeed. You know, does anyone have immunity as far as the Sedition Act is concerned?
No, no one has immunity.
Because I understand members of state assemblies have immunity when they debate in assembly.
In the assembly, yes, but there are some exceptions now. Mm-hmm. So there are some exceptions where you cannot speak about 153, you cannot attack things on language and race and religion and matters pertaining to the Conference of Rulers. So even if you say that in assembly, that could be seditious.
Okay.
And that was an amendment made to the Sedition Act.
Okay. So now, you know, with the spate of these incidents, you're going to have a lot of people afraid to express their legal opinions.
Yeah.
A lot of
people. We should be really afraid today as well.
Yeah. I am trying my best, Edmund. Fingers crossed. It's on record here. Legal opinion people, academic freedom people are going to hold back. The downside to that. But you cannot have too much of freedom of expression either, Edmund. That could also bring us down. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's so clear that we've said it many times. Human rights does not allow absolute freedom of expression and speech. But the limitations and restrictions must be proportional. You can't use an axe to kill an ant, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But what we see in practice today is that obviously the Sedition Act is being used for an ulterior purpose. And it stifles free speech, it stifles academic freedom. Yes, on the streets, you talk to people in the cafes and everyone is afraid. So the Sedition Act is the new ISA. People used to be afraid of ISA. We had to pacify them. Now we have to say, no, the Sedition Act shouldn't be the act to silence you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a lot of problems on the ground because people are afraid of expressing themselves.
Okay. We have a question from someone via text message. Why does it seem that some people seem to be immune or have some kind of immunity to the Sedition Act? And this is, you know, coming from the layperson.
Yeah.
It's what we read and what we're concluding in our minds,
yeah.
Right?
I think that question is a question that so many people ask. And the answer probably, I don't know the answer, but the answer probably is it depends on your political affiliation or what you say. So there is arguments that there is selective prosecution. However, in principle, I think lawyers in the human rights field and the bar has said that the Sedition Act must go. So even if it means defending people like the president of ISMA, we will defend the president of ISMA.
Mm-hmm.
He shouldn't be charged for the sedition under the Sedition Act, although we may personally disagree with what he says. There should be other ways of dealing with people like the president of ISMA. So in principle, we are against the Sedition Act, but to answer that question, it is selective prosecution. Not that they should be charged as well, but people say, why do some people get away and some people do not get away?
Mm-hmm.
We say that you should not be charging anyone at all.
Do you see the light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, yes. Like the ISA, the struggle. When the Malaysian Bar took up the struggle many years ago, the Malaysian Bar was one of the first. It was a very unpopular struggle against the ISA. And it took us how long to get rid of it? It's now very important for people to come together, express their disgust, be part of movements to get rid of the Sedition Act. And the Bar is having a nice walk very soon to speak very loudly with our legs why the Sedition Act should go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there should be massive support for these kind of movements.
Okay, we don't know when that is happening, though.
The Bar Council will be announcing it soon, I understand.
Okay. And would you settle for an amendment to the Sedition Act?
No, the Sedition Act must go. And the National Harmony Bill is there. So let's talk about the new bill. The Prime Minister has made his commitment. We support that commitment. And I think we should not look back and try and amend a law dated 1948 to apply to 2014.
Mm-hmm. I was at a conference and a former minister had mentioned this, and she said she didn't see a reason why we needed a Harmony Act. What would you say to that, Edmund?
I think the devil are in the details. So whatever you call it, let's look at the bill. Let's give it a chance. You cannot legislate love and peace and care for each other. I think that's through education. But you should have some form of legislation that is specific, that will criminalize racial and religious discrimination. And even more, we see today, political orientation discrimination. So you may come from one party, or you may support one party, and you may be discriminated against. And it leads to a slippery slope. The World War II, Hitler with the Jews, started out that way. And if we are not careful, we may go down that path, and that's really dangerous. So we have to be very cautious with what we do.
I'm just curious, Edmund. I mean, how do other countries deal with issues like these?
I think
I'm sure they have draconian laws like these as well in some countries.
Yeah, in many countries. But I think it's very clear that racial religious discrimination is a no-go. And legislation that's proportionate to limit free speech, to make sure that hate speech is criminalized in very limited circumstances, is acceptable.
Okay, any countries in particular that you would like us to emulate?
UK has good legislation. But of course, then
this is a UK legislation.
Yes, but the new UK legislation currently in place. But the real question is then the executive, the AG, and the police officers, are they going to use, although these laws are good, are they going to use it properly? So the first, of course, is the law, and the second is, of course, the personnel enforcing the law.
I think almost 3 years ago, Edmund, I had you on the show when Lawyer Buruk established the 9 pamphlets addressing separation of powers and, you know,
the
our
My
rights,
Constitution the campaign, My Constitution the Bar Council campaign.
That's right,
that's
absolutely.
Running now.
And there was one on the separation of powers. Does that come into play in situations like this?
Yes, we have always said that Parliament, the executive, and the judiciary must be separate, must be independent. But we, of course, see that Parliament is controlled by the executive. And although we have more opposition members, people assume that the opposition has more power in Parliament. But when it comes to a vote, the numbers still count. So in practice, we don't have that kind of separation we would like between the executive and Parliament, although in theory they are separate.
But does it really exist all over the world?
Oh yes, I think if there is a government that's responsive, that's progressive, they will listen to views and say, oh, there's so much opposition to this bill, let me withdraw it, let me amend it, let me put it to a select committee. It happens in different countries.
Really? It almost sounds like utopia to me, Edmund.
It's happened here off and on. Select committees have looked at some of the bills. Government has withdrawn or amended some of the bills. And I think that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. And it can work?
It can work if the government is responsive and would like feedback, effective feedback, mm-hmm. and constructive criticism.
Matthew is asking, do you think that the action taken by the authorities against statements made online is justified?
Yeah, it's a hard question, but statements online and statements offline, or whatever that means, and whatever that's not online, there should be a similar test. But government should have a really thick skin. And this part about criticizing government, criticizing a political party, should never be criminalized. It's okay all over the world, or many places in the world, to criticize government and to criticize a political party of a government. That can never be seditious. So online and offline statements should be treated the same. Of course, we have more people now using social media to criticize. I think the government needs to be slightly more tolerant for people to express their views, so long as those views do not call for incitement to hate and violence.
Huh. And therein lies the challenge, Edmund, to incite hatred. Who decides that? I mean, how do you decide that? It is very, very subjective, just like the whole Sedition Act, you know, in totality.
Yep. We can see it, because Malaysians, I think, generally are quite rational and quite educated. Yes, you have a lot of funny statements coming out on social media, and immediately you have thousands of users on Facebook criticizing that statement and not accepting that statement. And we have been living in peace and harmony for so long. People don't go out on the streets and beat up people just because of a statement on social media. So we will progress. But the more you clamp down, the more people would either go underground or would want to express even more extreme views. And that's really dangerous.
Okay, so this is to a certain segment of society who's connected, Edmund. What about those who are not? You know, those who are not really in touch with what's going on say, social media and stuff. How would they be protected to a certain extent?
Oh, I think they are in bliss now. All of us who are connected, I think, are suffering from more problems than those people who are not connected. Yep. Well, there's a lot of mainstream media, Utusan and The Star, that goes down to these rural areas who are not connected, but they will be connected one day. I think they are protected in terms of how we should conduct ourselves. And of course, they have their own avenues when they are not connected to express their views. I think that should be respected as well.
Oh, we have another question. Is freedom of expression the core of democracy?
Well, democracy has many features. Freedom of expression is one important feature. And in trainings, we always say this. If you can have food, you can have food and not starve. And that's economic right. But you also need freedom of expression, because one day when you run out of food, you need the right to express yourself, to tell government or tell people that I do not have enough food. So it's interconnected with all rights. And it cannot just be taken out as one and say that's the core. There are many other essential features: economic, social, cultural rights, education, culture. It's just that when a sedition is used, the freedom of expression under Article 10 is engaged.
Right. I'm going to move on from the Sedition Act to custodial deaths. Now, that's been in the papers recently as well. On September 5th, the Court of Appeal overturned the open verdict in the inquest of Teo Beng Hock's death and approved the application for a review of the case. What led to that overturn, Edmund?
Now, first of all, I think it's a brilliant decision by Arif Yusof, Ma Wing Koi, and Justice Hamid Sultan Abu Bakar. And it's really nice to see former members of the bar, learned friends, on the bench now, really progressing the jurisprudence. Teo Beng Hock's case now changes the standard of proof. It used to be that the victim had to show that the victim died beyond reasonable doubt. Now you do not need to show that. All you need to show is on a balance of probabilities, civil standard. Mm-hmm. That has now made it easier to show either accident, misadventure, or death caused by persons known or unknown. And I think Teo Beng Hock's case, where we did the RCI and looking at the notes of evidence at the inquest, it was so clear that something happened that day. And it was so clear that the MACC officers' name were looking after Teo Beng Hock. They had a duty to ensure that he doesn't die or that he is not caught in harm's way. And the decision was correct. It now calls into question all the inquests before Teo Beng Hock, where they applied the different standard of proof, which is one beyond reasonable doubt. So that changes it a lot. It means the police has a higher duty to ensure the safety of detainees. And really, if you do not do anything to the detainees, they shouldn't be dying, save for natural causes. And I think that the police now has... it's easier to go after the police now if somebody dies or is beaten up
in custody,
in lockup.
And of course, there was a landmark ruling on August 8th when the Court of Appeal maintained that a former constable, the police force and the government are liable for the death of a Coogan. Now, why landmark, Edmund?
Yeah, again, I think the amount of damages and the lengthy judgment of the High Court judge showed that the judiciary now is turning in terms of how they look at custodial deaths. Because in many cases, when lawyers file for custodial deaths, the judges previously would have asked for evidence, clear, direct evidence. Here in Coogan and Teo Beng Hock, the judges went, and quite correctly so, on circumstantial evidence and said circumstantial evidence is enough to show on a balance of probabilities that this death was caused by some persons who had custody of Coogan and Teo Beng Hock. So I think the police have to buck up. And I think we should not be tolerating people dying in custody anymore. We are sort of quite developed as a country, and we shouldn't be having one death. I think that the numbers are one death every 2 months or so.
Why do you think custodial death? I mean, there was a lot of noise around it the last couple of years. Do you think that's made a difference?
Yes, I think...
To these interpretations of the law?
Yes, I think public criticism and public opinion is very important. And the judges in Teo Beng Hock have also acknowledged that Teo Beng Hock's case is had attracted a lot of public interest. A lot of resources were also spent on the Royal Commission of Inquiry. And it's credit to the people for speaking out for Teo Beng Hock. It's credit to the campaigners for Teo Beng Hock who have been doing this for so long. But we cannot forget the other people who have died in custody. And it means that if somebody dies in custody, if you see a victim, I think people should fight for their rights. We have judges on the bench who are brave, who are courageous, who will say, well, the law is has to be changed. And they have changed the law in Malaysia because they said you no longer need to prove beyond reasonable doubt. You just prove beyond on a balance of probabilities. And I think you must commend the judiciary in these terms.
And you must commend the people as well for speaking up.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the family. And it's been really tough for Teo Beng Hock's family. And I think this victory is deserving not only for Teo Beng Hock and his memory, but for all those other people who have died in custody.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that comes to mind, Edmund, before we move on to the next show? Developments in the Malaysian legal scene that you want to talk about or bring to our attention?
Well, we just finished the Malaysian Law Conference yesterday, and today is the last day. I think law is changing so fast. The CJ has said it, our bar president has said it as well. And lawyers must change as well. We need to, of course, emphasize that without public support in the things that the bar does or lawyers do for human rights victims, the lawyers would not have the impetus to go on. And the call must be for all Malaysians to unite behind these causes to make our country a safer and better place to live in.
Mm-hmm. We wish you all the best, Edmund.
Thank you.
In your investigation and everything else. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Edmund Bond, human rights lawyer, on the developments in the Malaysian legal scene on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.